This is Flag Fly Forever with Mike Gianella, John Hegland, Samuel Hale, and the Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Team.
Welcome to episode 283 of Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Baseball podcast. With me are John Hegland and Samuel Hale. We are back.
We're back. Yeah, you couldn't kill us. You know, we are like, we are back for more. Whether you want us to be back or not, we are here to talk fantasy baseball. Going to be podcasting weekly, I assume, for the foreseeable future. It's pretty exciting. I've been excited about this. I'm glad we could make it happen.
You know what it reminds me of? The Michael Scott Paper Company, where a couple of us just went away for a little while, and then we came back once, you know, we just need a little bit of time. We needed to explore ourselves a little bit. That's all we needed. We just need a little bit of space away, but we're back, baby. We're back.
A little rum springa, as it were.
Yeah. I'm not sure who gets to be Michael Scott in this equation. Probably you, John, because you're the most famous of the three of us, so I'm going to give you that one.
No, definitely not.
I'm the closest to Scranton, Pennsylvania, so maybe that's me.
Yeah, actually, it probably is you.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about first baseman tonight, and we're going to sprinkle in a little bit of DH. We usually do go position by position, but because we're starting late, we're not going to do catchers and we're not going to do relief pitchers this spring. So sorry about that. If you were really looking forward to hearing about those positions, I know some people are like, oh, thank goodness, I don't really need to hear about them. But we're going to start with first base. So I wanted to mix it up a little bit this year and start out kind of with a big question. And John, like, what's your big question or big idea at first base? Like, when you look at the position in a macro, what do you think of or what do you see?
I mean, the first thing I notice is that, I mean, we have our typical elite options, you know, going in the first two rounds. But I feel like there's a very, very big middle class, I think, corresponding with the three-star tier that you outlined in the article at BP. And I find, you know, there are different statistical profiles for a lot of those players, but I find that middle class to be, there's a lot more acceptable options for me in that big chunk. So it's not that I'd hesitate if the timing was right to grab, you know, an elite option, but I'm also okay waiting a while and, you know, feeling like a lot of those players that go, I don't know, all the way down to, you know, around pick 160, 170, I wouldn't be sad to have some of those as my starting first baseman.
Yeah, so I have the same thought, and something I want to kind of try to do this year is look at things like from a big picture standpoint. So something I'm really thinking is I think I want two first basemen. Like, and I don't mind doubling up with some of those options in the middle, and we'll get to who those players are later, but I don't have the fear of like, oh no, like it's the middle of the position, it gets thin. Like we'll talk about that as we go around the diamond. First base really doesn't have that problem. Like, I don't want to oversell it. Like, you know, Josh Bell isn't equal to Matt Olson, but if I wind up with Josh Bell as my quarter infielder, I think I'll have done all right for myself.
Yeah, I think that seems right. And I think, you know, if you do wait to grab kind of a three-star after pick 100, then, you know, you just probably want to keep an eye out to grab that corner infield option not too long after that. So you have, you know, if you don't have an elite option, you have two pretty viable, you know, kind of 20 home run-ish players, you know, that don't have any area that's going to kill you. Obviously, steals is not a big category for the first baseman, so we can kind of chalk that off with maybe a couple of exceptions. But yeah, getting a couple in that mid-range, I think, is a totally acceptable way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're gonna do it a little bit differently this year. Last year we focused on the tiers. This year we're gonna focus more on ADP. I pulled up NFBC ADP from the last 50 Draft Champions drafts, which is January up until now. But before we do that, I'm going to dive into a quick note from our friends at Fantrax. If you haven't used Fantrax before, you definitely should, or at least consider doing so. It is the most customizable fantasy platform in the industry, and it offers the greatest experience for your Dynasty, Keeper, Redraft, and Best Ball leagues. Are you coming for another stat service? Fantrax makes it easy. Fantrax can import any of your current leagues and customize it if needed. Additionally, Fantrax offers the most in-depth player pool in the industry, including minor league players. It has a great draft room, and I've used it for Tout Wars, other industry leagues, and non-industry leagues as well, and I've had a great experience every time. I'd like to be commissioner, but if you need that, if you need a customizable commissioner service, Fantrax offers that as well. Fantrax offers more unique tools than anyone in the business. Waivers, FAB, unique scoring systems or schedules. Fantrax offers all solutions for all of that and more. Go to Fantrax.com and sign up today. That's Fantrax, Fantrax.com, the home of fantasy sports. All right, so let's get into the first baseman, John. Before we do that, so at Baseball Prospectus, we do designated hitter along with first base. So I kind of want to talk about the one, you know, player here we're talking about, and that's Shohei Ohtani. So first of all, do you have any problems with taking Ohtani like as a hitter only, which he is in essentially in many of these formats because you can't use him, you know, both ways. You have to make a choice. Do you have a problem taking him in the first round, like where he's going, or do you feel that he's a little much for you, or maybe, you know, I guess limits your flexibility?
So I have a rational thought and an irrational thought on Ohtani. So he's going middle of the first round, and in NFBC formats, of course, you can use him as either a hitter or a pitcher, but you have to make that decision for the week. And there aren't really many, if any, weeks where he's going to be a two-star pitcher because they space it out. So he's usually going once a week. My rational thought is that, you know, I don't like clogging up the utility in the first round. But it's not that I wouldn't do it. I might not pick Ohtani right there at pick 8. I might, if he falls a couple picks later, I might do it. You really have to focus, I think, on getting a number of multi-position players later on, so you have that flexibility, since you don't have the flexibility of the UT spot. I wonder how much he's going to steal going forward. You know, I think he was down, let's see, quick look at the Fantrax page. I don't know if you have his page up and you can tell me, but yeah, down to 11 steals last year from 26 the year before. You know, it's really hard to pick any other nits with his game. I mean, elite power, he's going to put up the counting stats. And, you know, my irrational thought is in an NFBC format, it just hurts that to know that because he's an elite hitter and an elite pitcher, that I have to choose. Most of those, you know, I think there's probably a little more value to be had with Ohtani as a hitter, but there are going to be some weeks, you know, and, you know, we were talking a little bit about this before the podcast, and maybe you want to say more about it, but, you know, having that ability to slot him in as a pitcher in some circumstances that could actually work for you in midseason. So I don't know if you want to say any more about that.
Yeah, so Derek Van Riper on Rates and Barrels brought this up, and, you know, I was talking to him about it, you know, privately, and, you know, this kind of blew my mind whole. It was one of those things I hadn't thought about, but he made the great point. So we often think about drafts as being static, right? And we get worried. And, you know, I saw Frank Stanfield took Ohtani, I think it was in a mock over at CBS where he works. And he was like, oh, man, I took Ohtani. And I felt like it, you know, kind of made me have to think, you know, through every pick in the draft because I was already locked in at DH. And now I had to, you know, fill additional players. But Derek's point was kind of like, well, sometimes during the season, I know it might seem weird, but if you have a good draft, you have so many hitters or you have hitters on the bench. Like, you know, if you have a hitter going into Colorado, for example, where you're like, hey, you know what? Like I can use this hitter going to Colorado for the week, you know, and I can use Ohtani as a pitcher. And, you know, because he is such a good pitcher, he was, you know, a top pitcher last year. I think in 2021, it was a different story because Ohtani was clearly the hitter. It was like, wow, like you almost have to use him as a hitter. He's so great. Used as a pitcher, he's good, but not, you know, as nearly as good as he was last year. It'd be silly. Last year kind of gave you the option, like, you know what, he's pretty great or close to great as both. I'm fine using him either way. And it's I guess what the other way that point that Derek was making is that sometimes we have those weeks, right, where we're looking at the free agent pool in a 15-team mixed league and like, oh my gosh, like there is nothing out there, but I need the innings, I need the strikeouts. I think all Derek's point was, it's not that you want or need to start Shohei Ohtani every week. It's just nice to know that maybe three or four times a year at most, you kind of have that option with him, and he's someone you can plug in. And it's an advantage you just literally don't have with any other player in the pool.
Yeah, I can see that argument. I mean, I guess if I had a counter, it would be that, you know, the variance from start to start can be so big that time, even if it looks like a favorable start, and, you know, he was so good last year as a pitcher that you have a pretty high floor, certainly for strikeouts, but trying to time those starts could be tricky. Although, you know, I do agree that if circumstances dictate that you need to make some roster adjustments, it is nice to have that, you know, that ace in the hole with Ohtani. So yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly an argument. I'm still drafting him as a hitter in mind, but thinking that it's kind of a break glass in case of emergency usage as a pitcher, probably.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. I don't think it's a huge advantage. I wouldn't consider pushing him up to number one, but he's someone I'd certainly, you know, consider where he's going, like seven or eight, and think, yeah, he's not someone bad to have. And I'm certainly not going to penalize him because I feel like, well, you know, he's sort of limited and there's not much I can do with him. I feel like taking him seven or eight kind of gives you some interesting flexibility in season.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So let's move to the top. Let's move to first base. There's a couple other DHs, but I don't think we need to talk about them very much. And John, if you want to, you know, mention them.
I have a whole rant on Franmil Reyes. No, I don't. I'm kidding.
Okay. Well, thank goodness. So let's talk about the top first baseman. So the top two rounds, there's four first basemen going, and that's, I think, a bit of a surprise because we've talked over the years about how first base has slipped. And maybe it has, maybe it hasn't, but it's pretty top heavy. So, you know, we've got Vladimir Guerrero going 12 right now, Freddie Freeman 14, Pete Alonso 19, and Paul Goldschmidt 27. So my feeling about all four of these players is, and I use this word a lot in my ADP pieces, I'm kind of agnostic. Like, I don't necessarily, like, I'm not against taking any of them, but I'm not going to jump where they're going either to be like, oh, you know, I have to have Vlad or I have to have Goldschmidt. Like, I'd be fine with any of them where they're going right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking of them as in terms of pairs, right? You've got the first round pair of Vlad and Freeman and the second round pair of Alonso and Goldschmidt. Like, I get the case for Vlad ahead of Freeman and I get the case for Alonso ahead of Goldschmidt, but I almost think the value is in Freeman and Goldschmidt because, I don't know, looking at Vlad and Freeman, I wonder, and you kind of planted this idea in my mind. I mean, I was kind of all in on Vlad last year, and I don't want to make the mistake of just backing off because, and it's not like Vlad was bad last year. He just didn't really return the top five, top six value that he was going for, but that launch angle is like 4 degrees. And I know what they're doing in Rogers Center. They're bringing the fences in, but they're also raising, I mean, they're bringing the fences in certain parts of the park, but they're also raising the walls. And I don't know if that's going to be a net positive. I mean, it could help his average. He could hit like 50 to 60 doubles, but I don't know that I think it's going to raise his home run total. And you made the point that a lot of the, you know, 2021 gaudy power stats were accomplished in Dunedin and Buffalo. So I don't know. I look at Freeman and I think, you know, it's, you know, the power might not be there in terms of like a 30 home run guy, but he could do it. But I mean, the average is pretty bankable. The counting stats, you know, he is one of the few players that could get 100 runs and 100 RBI. So I almost feel a little more comfortable going with Freeman toward the end of that round. So I don't know what you think about that comparison, but
So Freeman, I don't know how much he'll run, but he's sort of interesting in the sense that he gives you a little bit of everything, and he gives it, to you at a position, you know, as you alluded to before, John, not many other people run here. Goldie runs a little bit. I know there's a few other players, you know, further down that steal a few bases, but strategically speaking, you know, if you're looking to spread steals across your roster, as opposed to grabbing one or two, you know, big steal players and having the risk of, like, you know, like we saw with Merrifield last year, where if they slip or if they stop running, suddenly you have nothing because you have a player who isn't running. Freeman gives you some insurance against feeling later that you have to draft those players. Now the case I made for Vlad in my ADP piece this year is that if the Jays hadn't played, let's do a thought exercise. If the Jays hadn't played those 44 games in Florida and Buffalo in 2021, and you take the rest of Vlad's numbers, what you'd be looking at is a super talented hitter right now entering his age 24 season, who took a step forward in 2021 and maintained that in 2022. And you'd be like, wow, like, you know, he could go to another level. Like, he's still really young. You know, he finally, you know, improved in 2021, even though he didn't, you know, have the gaudy minor league, you know, park numbers. And he did the same thing in 2022. I think we kind of be floored by that. So Vlad's the upside pick here, but he's the upside pick with, at this point, to me, the floor is what, like maybe a third or fourth rounder. So I interestingly enough, I've kind of come to the other side of this, where I almost feel like I'd want Vlad here rather than Freeman, because Freeman feels like the safe pick, and I feel like there's enough safe picks in the first six or seven rounds that I kind of want to take the shot here with Vlad.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, it's the first round,
and they're both incredible fine hitters. Picks.
Yeah. I mean, you could actually see Vlad put up a line that, because I think his average should be much. What was it last year? It was in the 270s, I think. And I do think you can. I don't know if you can bank it, but I think you should expect. I just want to see what the projections are here. Yeah, you know, most systems have him like high 280s, low 290s. He was 274 last year. I mean, you could see Vlad easily put together like a 310 average, and, you know, he could do the counting stats that Freddie has done. And even if the home runs are around 30, obviously that's totally acceptable. He did steal 8 bases last year. I actually think he's not a zero in that category. He stole all 8 in the second half of the season, just like he woke up one day and was like, yeah, I want to steal some bases. So I think 5 to 10 is, you know, projectable, and that's helpful. So it's pretty much a coin flip. We can move on. Both great players.
Yeah. So the other two players here, I think it's the choice between that, like, top of the line power, you know, from Alonso. You know, if somebody's going to do or come close to doing what Aaron Judge did last year, you think it might be Alonso, and there's that upside versus Paul Goldschmidt, who, you know, amazing last year. Yeah, he faded a little bit down the stretch, but I feel like outside of the pandemic year, you just know what you're getting with Paul Goldschmidt, which is a great player no matter what the shape of the stats are.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised that, you know, Alonso is 6-7 picks ahead of Goldschmidt. But it's a smart group of drafters, and you don't want to be paying for last year's MVP season. I think you pointed out in your, I can't remember which article, but you pointed out that Goldschmidt faded a little in September. He is older. That said, I'm happy getting Goldschmidt toward the end of the second. Like, I think I generally want to pick toward the end of the first round, but you know, if I have an early pick and let's say I get a Trey Turner or a Jose Ramirez, and then coming back around, getting a power source like Goldschmidt, who is going to have a solid average, if not, you know, excellent. So I think he's totally legit. I don't have any concerns really about a steep drop off despite his age. I just think he was so good last year, and he's been good for the last couple of years that, you know, again, you're getting a pretty high floor. Alonso, I guess I was a little surprised to look at his stat line that, you know, he really has, you know, the average floor is a lot higher than I guess I had thought it was, you know, 271 last year. You know, he's cut down his strikeouts, totally solid, you know, kind of boring solid, like you're just plugging in those 40 homers and, you know, mm-hmm. he's not going to hurt you anywhere. He's just going to help you in those home runs and RBI. So, again, and the Mets are, you know, have a stronger lineup.
Well, the thing about Alonso is when he came up, you know, 26% strikeout rate, 26% strikeout rate. And then 2021, he dropped to 20%. And people are like, ah, that's kind of fluky. It'll probably go up somewhat. And then last year it was 19%. So like he's making smarter decisions. He's not, you know, swinging nearly so much at everything. And that's kind of the result is no, he'll never hit 300. But I believe the 260, 270 we've seen from him the last 2 years is sustainable. The projection models have him like kind of on the lower end of that. But I bet on 260 as opposed to him cratering and, you know, hitting 230.
And I actually just want to look really quickly at the projections to see, let's see, I think he's probably, yeah, I mean, there's Judge is the only one, I'm just going by Steamer, Judge is the only one with 40 plus home runs projected, but then the next cluster at 39 is Trout, Vladdy, which seems a little high, and Alonso and Schwarber. So, you know, he is not just a 30 home run guy, he's, you know, he's a 40 home run guy, and that makes, you know, a big difference. So,
yeah, that's a context thing, and we'll get into that in the next grouping, which is 40 home runs is not what it was 3 years ago. It's a big deal.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So speaking of the next grouping, unless you had, you know, more to add, I don't want to turn on this podcast, you know, where we spent an hour talking about, you know, the obvious choices. Matt Olson's kind of in a tier by himself. Like it's sort of interesting. He's 19 picks behind Goldschmidt. He's 44 ahead of, you know, the next first baseman who we'll talk about later. And what I find kind of interesting about Matt Olson is I think he's really solid. And I think exactly where I have him ranked, which, you know, we get into draft theory in another podcast. It means I won't get him unless the draft is chalk for 46 picks, which it won't be. But it's really weird because he's being drafted kind of close to his peak. You know, that one big year he had in 2021, he's certainly good. And I think what you're buying here with Matt Olson is the health and the floor, which is really high, but you're not, unless he takes some giant step forward, this is more of a, you know, get the value here with this player, particularly if you feel like you want elite or nearly production at first and, you know, don't want to wait for the next group.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about Olson, really. I mean, I think it's, you know, if you have gone like, you know, if you've leaned more towards speed in the first, with your first couple of hitters and you're a little short on power, this is a pretty good quick fix. Let's see, he's going in, what, the fourth round now? Yeah, yeah, right toward the beginning.
Like right at the beginning of the fourth, yeah, end of the third. Like, you know, another turn player, I guess. You know, you were talking about that before with Goldschmidt. Like, Olson's definitely one of those players on the turn. And I think one reason he might be going here, too, is, you know, teams might be, you know, using a little strategy thinking, okay, well, you know, I have to make my choice. I've heard this mentioned a lot in, you know, podcasts this year, people talking strategy, people talking ADP, where, you know, teams in a 15-teamer on the end kind of have to make those decisions because they have to wait and wait and wait for their next picks.
Yeah, like, so let's say you went, like, Freeman at the end of the first round. On the turn, you got Gerrit Cole, and then you went with Jazz Chisholm at the end of the third. You know, you're maybe a little light in power, and so I could see taking Olson in that kind of situation. I just think he is what he is. Like, that average from 2021 looks, that 271 looks like a bit of a mirage. And, you know, I think you bank a 240 to 250 and you're 30 plus homers and you move on.
Yeah. So, yeah, we don't need to, like I said, since we're in agreement and we think he's an okay pick here, but, you know, no one to really reach for. You know, I'd say if he drops like 5 or 10 picks from where he's at, I'm certainly going to have him, you know, if I have my pick there. But yeah, otherwise, I'm not chasing him. So let's see how to divide this. Let's go groups of five here. So actually, let's go with three just because they're close together. So we've got Jose Abreu, 90th, Vinny Pasquantino, 96, and Nathaniel Lowe, 106. So now we're looking at, you know, end of the sixth round, seventh round. And I know who my preference is here, John. I'm kind of curious, is it to, if you have one, or if you're, again, agnostic about this trio.
I thought I liked this trio a lot, and looking more closely, I'm not sure that I wouldn't just wait a little bit. Abreu, you know, the power dropped off considerably last year, and you think he's going to get some of that back with the move to Houston and the short porch in left field. You know, you should get a decent average. I'm a little bit skeptical of both Pasquantino and Lowe, to be honest. Like, I just think you're paying for most of the upside you can get for Pasquantino. I love the player. Like, I love the skill set, but it's a bad park and it's a bad team. Like, I think all these, the Royals in the top 100, so Witt, Melendez, and Pasquantino, I think are maybe a little too rich for what I want to pay. But Pasquantino, I don't know that I want to pay for the breakout. I guess Lowe to me feels like the pick here because he's, you know, he's the third of this tier. And I don't expect him to, you know, repeat what he did last year, certainly not in terms of a 302 average. But I think you are getting kind of everything. You're getting a good dose of everything. You know, some of the projections have him, he's a little light in homers. Like, he hit 27 last year, and the projections are mostly for the low 20s. But honestly, I might just wait and grab someone in the tier below.
Yeah, so I think Lowe's the guy I want here. And what's really funny is there's this belief that Abreu is going to hit 30 home runs and hit 300, and that Houston's going to, you know, help his career. And, you know, I always want to call them the crawfish boxes, but the Crawford boxes are going to make him hit a bunch of homers. And my feeling is like, well, I could see him hitting 300. I could see him hitting 30 home runs. I don't see him doing both. Like, if he sells out for power, it's going to impact his average. He might just keep hitting for average because that's what he does. I could see like low 20s home runs. I'm okay with Pasquantino. It just feels to me like people are assuming a giant leap for a player who, it's mostly the power. He really didn't hit for a ton of power last year. Could he do it? Yeah, he's a talented player. But I don't necessarily want to make the bet. So I think we're on the same page here as well. Like, if I'm going to reach here, Lowe's the player I want to reach for. But what's really interesting is it's when you kind of get down like past this. So I find that almost all of these first basemen, and by the way, just to, you know, let you in on some behind the scenes stuff here. So I put together a Google sheet for John and Samuel before we started, and like a dope, I forgot a couple players because this is a first base only sort. So I forgot to put in Joey Meneses, John, and Seth Brown. So when we get down to them, we'll just
don't think I didn't notice.
Yeah, don't forget them.
I'm
just a dope.
You know, this Meneses erasure will not stand.
Okay, I'm fine with Joey Meneses, so it's not just, like, I'm not making a commentary on him. But yeah, there's a whole grouping here which I think starts with Rhys Hoskins and, you know, goes down to Ryan Mountcastle, where I kind of am here for most of these players. Oddly enough, another player I omitted, it's the one guy I'm not too excited about. It's Andrew Vaughn, at least not at price. But just about all these first basemen, like Rhys Hoskins, CJ Krohn, Christian Walker, Rizzo, Mountcastle, I'd be fine with any of them at first. And some of it is where you're at in the draft at this point. It's not so much the player, but it's the concept of, wow, like, I can get, you know, 25 to 30 home runs. Maybe the average won't be great, but, you know, I expect most of them to play every day. I understand that, you know, the limitations of CJ Krohn. He's a brutal hitter on the road. Something I really liked about him last year is, you know, I had him in Tout Wars, and I was able, because I always had somebody decent on my bench, to just kind of cycle him out for those weeks where they're on the road and be like, yeah, I just won't use him and I'll use somebody else. And I will essentially have this great half a player, you know, for 80, you know, games or whatever it was, and then just cycle in, you know, somebody else and leave him on the bench. I think once or twice I had injury where I had to use him and it kind of stunk, but yeah, for the most part, it can work really well in a league with any kind of roster flexibility, unless it's an only.
Yeah, I don't love that drafting someone on the premise, you know, in the top 150 picks on the premise that you're only going to use them at home. But I think, you know, Rockies and Crone in particular, because his splits were pretty dramatic, I think that that's a totally fair use case for him. So I have no problem with it.
Is there anybody here, you know, I know it's just easy and reductive for me to say I like all these players except Andrew Vaughn. Is there anyone here that you specifically do like in this group that you're like, yeah, like I could really see, you know, having this player in, you know, a number of places this year?
Well, I'll just, yes. I was struck by what a, after a really horrible start, Christian Walker put together a really great, basically May through September. It's backed up by, you know, StatCast numbers. His batted ball data is really nice. I'm kind of more interested. I've never really been interested in this player, but, I'm kind of interested in Ryan Mountcastle because same thing. He's young. His team is much better, or it's getting better. And he also has really great batted ball data, you know, I guess you could say, well, they, you know, moving the wall back in Camden Yards, you know, really hurt the power. But I'm looking at his spray chart and it looks like he lost like two or three. Well, I don't even know if those were home or road, but you know, at worst, it was like a couple to three homers.
Yeah.
So, you could overplay that.
So what's interesting about Mountcastle, I was all in on him last year, and I was really excited about him, and I was like, the power is going to play. And what's odd is that it's one of those cases where I was right, even though the results didn't support it. Like you're right. Like he didn't lose a lot of home runs because of the dimensions. You would think, you know, if you look at a lot of Orioles, they hit a ton of home runs on the road and then they suffered, you know, in Camden. Mountcastle was a split. Like he hit 11 home runs at home, 11 on the road. His average was much worse on the road. I think Mountcastle's problem is that he swings at everything and the plate discipline kind of affects him. He makes some bad choices. If he made better choices and if he had a little bit more, I don't want to change to the point where he's not swinging at anything and is too passive. But if he made some better choices, more things would go his way. But I agree with you. The raw power is good enough that I could see him coming closer to what he did, you know, in 2021, you know, fences or no. I kind of made this point about him coming into 2022, which is, and I said this at the time, I'm not comparing them. If you take out that lousy first month that he had in 2021, his numbers look a lot like Pete Alonso's that year. And again, major caveats. I'm not saying that Ryan Mountcastle is going to become Pete Alonso. Samuel, you can, you know, splice that any way you want and turn that into a bumper. But seriously, though, I could see Mountcastle hitting kind of going on the upper side of his projections, which is upper 20 home runs and, you know, 260, 265 average, which would be great at this price.
Yeah. And even with the free swinging, like the contact's so good that I think you do have a decent floor for the average. You sounded like a disappointed parent when you were like, he needs to make better choice. You need to make better choices. Can we make better choices?
I'm old enough now where I am the disappointed parent for, you know, all these players when they don't work out for my fantasy team. And then, you know, Anthony Rizzo kind of is what he is. I think I just like him because he's one of those weird players who was sort of underrated last year in part because he was a free agent and the drafts were weird. I didn't expect a giant bump for him, and I know there's an average penalty, but he really benefits from the park he plays in. Like, there's just not much more to say. And he resigned with the Yankees, I think, knowing that at this stage of his career, he kind of needs that boost.
Well, and we haven't talked about it yet, but there, you know, I've heard a lot of people speculating that he, more than most players, will be helped by the shift ban. So we'll see. I don't know if that's going to make a huge difference. Like, I don't know if any of these rule changes will make a huge difference, but it certainly can't hurt someone like Rizzo. So
yeah, I know left-handed hitters, particularly left-handed pull hitters, are the ones who benefit. You know, so a less talk thing about the shift ban, and we won't talk about it, or the change, you know, the change, and we won't talk about it first, is people are talking a lot about like pull hitters and hitting the ball hard. This won't occur at first, but a lot of speedy players where a ball gets into the gap and before there was an easy out, and now, you know, you'll have to have a good fielder and have to make a good throw or get to the ball in time. I think we're going to see some of these burners get some infield singles that we weren't seeing for years because of the shift. That's something as a fan I'm looking forward to. I like an exciting play.
Hey, yeah.
You know, where the defender has to, you know, hustle and get over there.
Just make it more like the 80s. Make everything like the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we love.
That was our heyday. So going to the bottom of this group, you've got Ty France, Rowdy Tellez, Josh Bell, and you know, I haven't forgotten you. I love you, Joey Meneses. And the two I like here are France and Bell. Ty France got hurt last year. He had a wrist injury. It clearly affected him. I kind of noticed, like, it's that thing. You know, I love batting average. Like, Ty France just hits the ball. This is not a power pick. This is a pick where if you've gotten your power, but maybe you took someone earlier who's a bit of an average drag, I think France is a nice, he's not empty average either. He's a nice counterbalance to that. And man, I know Josh Bell, you know, kind of slumped after the trade last year to the Padres, but I just still believe that there's a big power year in him.
Yeah, I agree. I think Bell is, you know, is a nice pick for a bounce back. And I'm glad you brought up France. I didn't want to steal your thunder because I know he was your value pick in this tier. Yeah, and you make the point that I would just underscore is that when you get to this part of the first base pool, there aren't that many that can help you in average and still give you credible power. I like that France, he's probably the number two hitter. So you're hitting behind Julio and then in front of some mashers, because basically it looks like you'll have Teoscar, Cal Raleigh, and Eugenio Suarez. So just a lot of power behind him. So it's a kind of a nice, even though the Mariners line up top to, you know, you get down to the bottom, it's a little sketchy, but I think they have a pretty good, you know, top half of the order. And I think France kind of nestled in there is going to benefit from that.
Yeah, I you know, most outside of one, like a handful of teams, most teams have a sketchy bottom of the order. It's one of those things. It's the nature of putting lineups together in 2023.
Can I show you the San Francisco Giants?
I have, you know, I've studied this intently because I've been, you know, doing rankings and lists and this, that, and the other, and I just cannot believe the San Francisco Giants. But we'll get to some of that in, you know, another podcast. So anything else here? I know some people love Rowdy Tellez. Like I'm fine. Again, I'm fine with him. I just don't see him coming on a lot of my teams because unlike Rizzo, I could see a year where Tellez's average just really bottoms out and it's ugly enough that I don't want to take him, you know, about 165 or so.
Yeah. I guess if I need sort of, you know, cheap power out of my corner, you know, I don't hate it, but yeah. I am worried about that average. I mean, projections are in the 240s, which would be fine, but
it seems, you know, generous.
I could see it crater. I mean, 219 last year, and yeah, it's you're getting to the point where this is really just a power play. You're starting to the other categories are starting to drop off at this point in the pool.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of dropping off, you know, we get to, you know, I mentioned Meneses, and then something I should mention about Meneses and Seth Brown, and that this is how I want to make this more integrated this year. You know, I mentioned him. I mentioned Vaughn. We'll get to how outfield's kind of thin, but I suspect that one or two of these players are going to wind up slotting into somebody's outfield just because there's more uncertainty at the bottom of outfield than there have been in years past. So if you are drafting here thinking, oh, there's so many first basemen, it's just something to keep in mind. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody, you know, slips Meneses or Seth Brown into their outfield. And, you know, if you're thinking, oh, there's so much of a cushion, I don't have to worry. You know, don't get too cute. Like, don't wait and wait and wait. Like, if you like somebody here, definitely take them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm not, you know, I'm still scarred by Frank Schwindel. And I know at BP, Robert Orr wrote about how Meneses is a little more promising than Schwindel as far as like a, you know, an older post prospect kind of flash. He flashes for half a season. I probably won't own him on any teams, but, you know, it looks like he has the job. And if, when you're getting around pick 200, it's not like you're making a big investment.
Yeah. The thing with Meneses and Seth Brown, for that matter, there's a penalty to me for players who on really bad teams, because I don't expect the runs to be there. I don't expect the runs batted in to be there. So it's that idea of like, even if they keep the job all year, and, you know, even Meneses is fine and hits, you know, say 20, 25 home runs, there's a bit of a drag that comes with that, because I suspect there are not going to be a lot of ducks on the pond. By the way, so a comparison I made with Seth Brown, and I'm sorry about this, John. He kind of reminds me of this year's Lamont Wade Jr., where I feel like, you know, he's got that vibe where he was really good last year and put up a lot of good counting stats. And if Seth Brown does the same thing, or if he disappears entirely, I wouldn't be surprised by either outcome.
Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. So I mentioned in my ADP piece that I'm out in Josh Naylor, but I have to say, the more I look at Naylor, particularly given his price, like he's 18 picks ahead of Tristan Casas, and I'm sort of like, you know, I'd rather have what I know in Naylor if I'm going to be diving this deep than Casas, who, you know, I get the promise, and, you know, he looked good for a few at-bats in September, and he hit the ball really hard. I just don't feel like I'd rather take the player I know is going to play a Naylor, even though he's most likely to be a platoon.
Yeah. I think we might disagree, Mike.
Wow.
I think Casas, like, I could, you know, if in fact he has the everyday job at first for Boston, and I don't even know what that team is doing, but, I think the on-base skills are really intriguing. Like, I would almost rather the upside there than Naylor here, who, as you say, it's kind of boring. It's fine. But you don't have to, you know, someone like Casas around pick 200, he's someone you can move on from if he pulls a Bobby Dalbec.
Yeah. See, that's interesting, because to me, it's probably like a 250 or so, where I'm starting to look at the upside. I feel in a 15 teamer, this is still where I want to get some stats. And I guess a good example last year is someone like O'Neill Cruz. Like, he was going just outside the top 200. I think he shot up a little bit later, and he kind of broke even, but he only broke even because he came up, you know, mid year and all that. But Casas, I guess if Casas is up opening day and he's productive, he'll certainly break that. It might just be a philosophical thing, John. Like, I still want some certainty before pick 250, after pick 250. Like Miguel Vargas, for example, who I was going to mention, is at 267. I love the upside at 267. I said I was out on him.
Yeah,
that was before, you know, the Dodgers apparently announced he's going to play second base, which, it seems like more of a thought experiment than something that's really going to happen. But
right,
the point is, he's their starter. So I like the gamble there on Vargas.
I mean, Casas is going around pick 240. So we're not that far off from the 250 threshold, right? And he's going by these ADPs that you have on the sheet, he's going almost 20 picks after Naylor. So,
yeah,
you know, so I think with that value in mind, I'd rather go Casas around later. But yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, I think that is probably around where I'll start to play for more upside. So,
yeah. So, you know, speaking of upside, if you had to go here, you know, I guess that Vargas, I like more and more, the more I kind of dig in, and the more it really seems like the Dodgers are going to let him play. I'm intrigued by their defensive alignment, because the shift is going away, and I assume that they signed Miguel Rojas to give them one defender, where it's like, okay, like, we're going to have this great defender. Maybe the argument for Vargas at second is, well, we have a solid, you know, first baseman in Freddie Freeman. we can't shift, but we can certainly, you know, when a right-hander is up, like shade them and, you know, have them go over as far as possible. It just still seems weird.
Freddie Freeman is not going to make up for Max Muncy at third, Gavin Lux at short, and Miguel Vargas at second.
He can't play the entire infield. I do wonder if we're going to see a lot of Rojas in the fifth or sixth inning or early, or like they pit, you know, they're like, okay, the, you know, we've got Kershaw going today. It's a right-handed heavy lineup. We're putting Rojas at short. Lux will play second, and, you know, Vargas today, you know, won't play, or Vargas play third and Muncy won't play. You know, they'll cycle people in the DH. I know I'm kind of, you know, getting far afield. There's the interesting thing too about the new rules, which is some teams will have a plan, some teams won't have a plan, and some teams will kind of plug and play the first month and in spring training or whatever, and then say, all right, well, this didn't work, we're going to try something else.
And Max Muncy is going to be injured by the end of April, so all this will be moot. I mean, I don't, you know, Max, I hope you stay healthy, but he's, you know, he's been putting off what, UCL surgery for. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, signing Rojas, it's like, yeah, he's our utility guy. He's our, you know, he's our kind of Swiss Army knife across the infield. But, you know, Miguel Rojas is probably going to end up having at least 500 plate appearances for the Dodgers.
So when does Matt Mervis come up? Does he, I mean, I know it looks like he's pushed back now because they signed a boatload of people, but do we see Mervis in June? Do we see him in July? Is he going to spend a whole year in the minors? What's the plan there?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know why you're a 500 team at best and you go and sign Eric Hosmer and Trey Mancini without, you know, giving your 24-year-old prospect a shot. I don't know. June, let's say June.
Yeah, I kind of understood Hosmer because I looked at that like, well, he's no obstacle for Mervis. They'll just push him aside. When they sign both, it's like, that's strange to say the least. And then, you know, the other upside players here, we don't have to gloss over Will Myers. Will Myers, when I wrote my ADP article, was underpriced. Now he's appropriately priced. I think he's fine kind of going where he is. Yes, I get there's a park bump, but he's also been very uninspiring at this point for what, half a decade? Maybe I'm overstating it, but.
Well, he doesn't seem to run as much or really at all.
When he gets hurt, there's just a lot of stuff with Myers where, again, I get it. Maybe this is the year in Cincinnati that there a lot of power comes, but he's fine where he's going. I don't really want to push him up beyond that.
So he's going right next to Casas. So straight up, Myers or Casas for you?
Probably Myers, because again, so something about Casas too, and this is the whole rookie conundrum. Like the last couple of years, we've really seen most young players, not all of them, but many of them have struggled. And I'm still not sold that Casas is just going to hit the ground running. I think now some of this is draft dependent too, right? Like if I've had a safe, boring, middle of the road draft and I like my offense, maybe I take Casas. Maybe like, you know what? Let's just take the stab here. I think some of this question comes too. Realistically, Casas at this point is your corner infielder. He's not your first baseman. So what are you getting on reserve for Casas? Are you comfortable, for example, with Jared Walsh on, you know, like later going, you know what? I'll take Casas and, you know, I'll just take a stab in the dark at Walsh in the 23rd round. And if Casas doesn't work, Walsh is my corner.
Lamont Wade, that's who I'm taking.
Lamont
Wade. So just last thing.
Brandon Belt. I mean, that's another, you know, pitch to the plan too. Sorry, I keep twisting the knife on this
podcast. So all of Casas's projections have him over an 11% walk rate. OBPs generally 340s and 350s. The average is not great, but it's not horrible. It's, you know, 240s to 250s. WRC plus, except for the Bat X, all of them have him above average, you know, with Steamer at 124 WRC plus. So I'm just saying, this is not maybe the skills profile maybe gives him more of a floor than you would project for most rookies. So I guess that's why I'm okay with Casas here. I think there might be a floor. I guess the question is, if he comes out struggling, you know, then does he just immediately go back to AAA?
So it's a weird WRC plus though, because I'm looking at Steamer and like the homers are light. This goes back to the argument I kind of made about Washington and Meneses earlier. The runs in RBI are kind of light compared to some of their first basemen. And, you know, it's funny. I look at the profiles or the projections. He and Miguel Vargas look awfully similar. And, you know, Vargas is going later. It's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, I mean, I think he's going, he could be a, well, it's weird, like great or solid, at least real life players who, in fantasy, you're like, okay, like he's fine.
Yeah, look, I'm not gonna, I did not come into this podcast planning to be the Tristan Casas guy, so
yeah.
But you know, I'm intrigued, but you know, we don't have to spend any more valuable airtime on Sox first baseman.
Yeah, so I guess kind of wrapping up here, like, so the one last prospect. Do we have any hope for Spencer Torkelson? Like, speaking of somebody who's just cheap, you could certainly just add him and be like, you know what? Like, let's see what happens here.
I mean, he's a 1-1 pick.
So was Mickey Moniak. He's
a 1-1 pick that actually deserved to be a 1-1 pick. So
fair enough.
End game pick. I'm fine with it. I think he's got to take a step forward, and you know, the skills aren't terrible. Like, he's walking close to 10%, strikeouts are under 25. Like, I don't know. I think it's too early to write him off. Yeah. Definitely a end game option at best.
Yeah, fair enough. And then I lied. I said it wouldn't talk about DHs. So an interesting wrinkle this year is that there's some DH onlys in most leagues, Shea Langeliers, Francisco Alvarez, and Mitch Garver. Right now they're DH only in most leagues or most formats. At some point, you know, they're going to get catcher eligibility. So how do you handle that? Langeliers obviously is the guy who's going to be up on opening day. So he should get that catcher eligibility pretty early. Do you like the idea of kind of taking Langeliers where he's going, you know, at about pick, you know, in the 270s, and then just taking a garbage catcher or, like, you know, whatever you can get in the last round and thinking, okay, I'll just like manage it this way? Or do you feel like that's a waste of draft capital?
I don't think any of these players are good enough to like do that kind of, you know, to wait around for, to be honest.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You know, so I'm probably, even if Langeliers was eligible at catcher, he would be like an end game second catcher option for me. So, no, I'm not going to draft them. You know, Alvarez, like many rookie catchers, that I think, like, you know, we're backdoor sneaking a catcher discussion into the first base.
Yeah, I know. See what I did there?
But like, I think it's crazy how early Logan Ohapi is being drafted. I think, Alvarez, who else? The Rodriguez for Pittsburgh.
We just don't know when he'll be up. I mean, I think he'll be good, but
the catchers that are good right away. Like, who is good right away? Adley Rutschman is good right away.
Yeah, it's just such a rarity.
He's a generational talent. And most of these players, I mean, look, I'm not even out on Joey Bart yet. Like, I think he's...
Oh, God.
No, I'm not. But it takes time for a lot of these catchers. And I think, it's not my way to go to draft rookie catchers really at all. So,
yeah. No, I mean, I'm with you, and I faded Rutschman last year, and really didn't regret it because he came up like so much later. And you're right, like, to turn it back to DH, when you have this additional impediment where he's a DH, like, you're kind of stuck with him, the juice probably isn't worth the squeeze, especially in a redraft. And a keeper, obviously, it's a whole you know, different story. But in most keeper leagues, these players are just taken anyway. So anything else on first base that you want to add before we close out?
Just keep an eye out for Washington State Cougar Kyle Manzardo, who will likely get a call up to the Rays in the middle of the season. Not one to draft, but to just put on your watch list.
At first I thought you were talking about somebody still on the Washington Cougars. I was like, wow, this is like Larry Schechter dropping at like one of the expert drafts. Alex Bregman's my nephew.
My nephew who's 12. You draft him in your keeper league. It's just rare that Washington State, and if anyone doesn't know this, that's where I work. They don't get too many players in the majors. So Manzardo, he's like a, he's got no position in the field. He's a natural born DH, but he can rake. So keep an eye out.
Yeah, I can see him up in June. It wouldn't surprise me at all. So yeah, if you're in a draft champions or a really deep, you know, league with lots of reserves, he's somebody I'd kind of start looking at in the, you know, late 30s, early 40s for sure. Thank you once again for listening to episode 283 of Flags Fly Forever, a Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Baseball podcast. Don't forget, we are in the middle of our awesome preseason coverage. You've got my tier articles, you've got my ADP rankings, but there's so much other coverage. There's targets and avoids, there's Jesse Roche's awesome, you know, dynasty coverage, and really just about everything else you could ask for. Additionally, the Baseball Prospectus Annual is available, so please order that if you haven't already, or go to your local bookstore and do the old person, old school thing and purchase it in person. For Mike Gianella, John Hagelin, and Samuel Hale, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be in your ears again next week.
We're back.
Bye, y'all.